Good evening from Sizzle Recital Hall at Montana State University, Billings. And we welcome you to an evening with Martin Goldsmith, co-sponsored tonight by Yellowstone Public Radio and by Temple Beth Aaron here in Billings. And I want to thank Andy Rio, president of the congregation, and other members of the congregation who are here tonight, who are also responsible for providing the audience here with some refreshments after the event is over. And that'll also give you a chance to chat with Martin and Amy, and also maybe to get your books signed. And I'm sure Martin would be happy to do that. Thomas, I didn't ask, but I figured John Wiley and Sons would hear about it if he didn't, so. Thomas Books, Susan Thomas is available out in the hall to sell Martin's book if you want to buy one tonight. You can listen to his talk first and decide, you know, you don't have to make up your mind now. Susan is a supporter of public radio and an independent bookseller here in Billings. Before we begin, I have to say a few words about John Washburn Fisher, one of the founding members of this public radio network in Bozeman, who passed away this last week at the age of 81 of a heart attack. And I have to say a few words about John, which is easy for me to do. I've admired the man since I came here in 1984. He had gone around Bozeman twisting people's arms to contribute money to the local share of the translator over there to get a translator on the air, which went on the air in 1984. And then he and Bob Leo, another enthusiast for public radio, would climb up the hill when the translator failed. These are both retirees, by the way. They climb up the hill and shovel the snow away from the building, sometimes 6 or 7 feet of it, and put the translator back on the air. Bob was a retired engineer, and John had a four-wheel drive vehicle. That was the kind of commitment which is not unusual for public radio civic-minded people to do, but that's what he did for his community. John Fisher was a retired Foreign Service officer who served in Austria and in South America and other places during his career. He came back to Bozeman to retire, and in addition to public radio and television, he was committed to the quality of education at Montana State University, and also served for a long time on the Public Library Board in Bozeman, as well as other civic commitments. And we'll miss him. In 1994, I decided to invite Martin Goldsmith to come to Bozeman to speak at MSU Bozeman. And Amy Roach at the time was the arts and humanities reporter on our staff here in Billings. And I said to Amy a couple days before Martin arrived that he has a life and a background that goes way beyond performance today, and I think you ought to interview him. And she was reluctant. She said, you might have to drive all the way over there just for, you know, a half hour interview. And I said, well, you don't have to. But I'd appreciate it if you would. So she did, and I have taken complete credit, along with the radio station, of course, and with the friends of public radio, because they had a meeting over there at the time, so I mean, I'm not completely responsible. But sparks flew. I mean, it was visible. It was visible in the hall at the Holiday Inn over there. But there was electricity in the air, and this was not usual for Amy's interviews. Well, it wasn't unique, but it wasn't usual. So she came, she came home to Billings Monday morning. I said, well, how did your interview go? And she said, he's a great kisser. And again, this is not something that I normally expect employees to report upon completing their professional responsibilities. They carried on a correspondence and a lot of heavy-duty phone bills for a few years and were married a year ago, last October. I tried to convince them last summer that they'd been married 2 years already, but that's my problem, not theirs. And but it is a year ago last October. Okay, lovely wedding. It was a wonderful wedding, and I was pleased to be invited and pleased to be there, as were a few other of us here in Billings. But we have told every visitor from the national level since 1994 has come out here. Steve Curwood came out here, and John Merrill came out here, and Carl Castle came out here, a few others, that none of them were to return to Washington or New York or Boston with any of our staff. And it's been in the contract since then. It is my pleasure to introduce my wonderful friend and Martin's wonderful wife, Amy Roach.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Marvin, for that, what else can we call it, Marvin-esque introduction. As Marvin mentioned, he was at the wedding. He did not mention that he gave the toast at the wedding. And in that classic Marvin style, it was at least as long as the wedding ceremony itself. And every bit as intimate. And my mother and father, of course, were there that night, so I gave him a warning that he could say anything he wanted to in his toast, as it kept in mind that my mom would be there, as she would say, with both ears open. So I guess I'm glad that she's out of range of the Yellowstone Public Radio signal tonight in Iowa, so we're safe. I want to thank Marvin and everyone here at Yellowstone Public Radio for inviting Martin and me here tonight to talk to you. And I also want to thank you, everyone in the audience, for coming. And I see a lot of friends, and I can't wait to catch up with everyone at the reception afterwards. So thank you for being here. I left Billings 4 years ago. It was, to be exact, 4 years and 2 days ago. Friday was the fourth anniversary of the day that I loaded up my 1978 Ford Fairmont Futura and attached a U-Haul to the back and started driving east for Washington, D.C. At the time, I was eager to begin my new life with Martin, and I had no idea how much I would miss Marvin and Yellowstone Public Radio and my friends and life under the big sky. All over Washington, D.C., there are bus stops everywhere, and there are a lot of these little shelters at the bus stops, and on the side of many of these shelters are posters advertising various products. And one that I would see now and then walking the streets of Washington, D.C., was a poster of the Marlboro Man, and every time I saw it, I would burst into spontaneous tears of homesickness, thinking of Montana. And I think I knew that in seeing that cowboy out of place on those busy city streets, I felt out of place there too, and he seemed to tap into some of those feelings. The Marlboro Man no longer holds sway over my emotions to the same extent, but I still do miss Montana every hour of every day, and I miss KEMC and the folks here. There's simply no place like it on Earth. Then there's no one like Marvin. I consider him my mentor in many things, not just radio. He's also one of my very dearest friends. I'm sure you already know how much he brings to the cultural life of Montana and Wyoming, but I'm learning more and more about that all the time in recent years. Washington, D.C. has two public radio stations, and neither of them can hold a candle to Yellowstone Public Radio. Okay, I have to digress just a little bit. I know I'm here to introduce Martin, and I will. I'll do that very soon. But when we were preparing for our wedding, we would joke together that instead of exchanging wedding bands, we thought we would get matching ear tags, like cattle. We'd be able to find each other that way. And I thought this was very funny. So I was telling everyone I knew at work at C-SPAN about this, and there was always this sort of silent, quizzical response, and I realized finally that they had no idea what an ear tag is. So now there are all these people at C-SPAN walking around trying to use the term ear tag in a sentence. I've educated them a little bit, westernized them just a little. Now, about Martin Goldsmith. I didn't believe in love at first sight until I met Martin. When I interviewed him six and a half years ago in Bozeman, I was instantly, irrevocably smitten. In fact, I had a hard time just getting through that interview. He'd answer one of my questions in that fluid, musical voice of his, and then the voice would stop, and I'd realize it was my turn to ask a question again. But I didn't want to ask him a question. I just wanted to look at him. Or giggle. I did a lot of giggling and staring. Those were my main contributions to that interview. As many of you may have noticed, because after all, you were listening. Martin and I shared our first date with 30,000 listeners. Of course, I was already familiar with Martin's beautiful voice as a longtime listener to Performance Today, NPR's daily classical music program. And speaking of Performance Today, I'd like to invite just a little audience participation. Does anybody here miss Martin's voice on Performance Today? Well, as you know, Martin left. The crowd is turning ugly. There's heckling in the back. Martin left Performance Today in October of 1999 after 10 years as host of the program. During Martin's tenure with Performance Today, the show grew from being heard on 40 stations to being heard on 220 stations for a total of 1.6 million listeners. His talents were recognized in his last year when the show won the Peabody Award, the highest award in broadcasting, for 10 years of broadcast excellence. He was also awarded Yale University's Cultural Leadership Citation in recognition of service to the cultural life of the nation. Martin did a fair amount of high-voltage hobnobbing at NPR. For example, when Performance Today celebrated its 10th birthday, Martin hosted a concert in the East Room of the White House with President Clinton and Senator-to-be Hillary Clinton in attendance. At NPR, he had occasion to interview Robert Shaw, George Schulte, Beverly Sills, and all the bright lights in classical music. And when Performance Today broadcast the American premiere of Paul McCartney's Standing Stone from Carnegie Hall, Martin did the interview with Paul McCartney. And if anyone's interested, I know he would love to show off his autographed Sgt. Pepper CD, his most cherished possession. Before joining NPR in 1986, Martin spent 12 years with WETA, a public radio station in Washington, D.C. He also worked professionally as an actor during those years, performing in Macbeth, Butler, Elephant Man, and many other plays on Washington stages. Martin was born in St. Louis, where his mother was a member of the St. Louis Symphony, and where he had the privilege of attending Stan Musial's last game with the St. Louis Cardinals. The year Martin turned 15, his mother joined the viola section of the Cleveland Orchestra. The family moved to Ohio, and Martin transferred his allegiance to the Cleveland Indians. He finished high school in Cleveland, and then majored in history at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, returning to Cleveland each year for a summer job at WCLV, the job that launched his radio career. Martin played the French horn, sang in the chorus of the Baltimore Opera Company, and even made a guest appearance with the Washington Opera. Martin plays shortstop on NPR's softball team, coached by Bob Edwards. He's a mean shortstop. I once saw him break his finger in the warm-up and go on to play the entire nine innings. And he's had the great fun. He would come over between innings, and I would try to soak up the blood with something, some towel that I found in the car, and then he'd go back out there. He's had the great fun of being guest sportscaster for three minor league baseball teams, the Arkansas Travelers, the Norfolk Tides, and the Abilene Arsenal. And the Billings Mustangs could have him in a moment. If anyone here is well-connected with the Billings Mustangs, he'd be on the next plane, I think. Martin Goldsmith is currently senior commentator for National Public Radio and the program director for both the classical and opera channels at XM Satellite Radio, which debuts nationally in September. Tonight, Martin is here to talk about his latest achievement, his book, The Inextinguishable Symphony, a true story of music and love in Nazi Germany. It's the extraordinary story of his parents' lives as young Jewish musicians in Nazi Germany. Both of them performed with the Jüdischer Kulturbund, the Jewish Culture Association. The book is a testament to the power of music and love to endure even the unimaginable suffering of the Holocaust. The Inextinguishable Symphony, now in its fourth printing, is the first book ever written about the Kulturbund's contributions to cultural life in Germany, as well as the first book ever written by Martin Goldsmith. It's been a rare privilege for me to know Martin during this significant time in his life. When we first met, he was just beginning his quest into his family's past. It has been a deep honor to accompany him on his emotional exploration into his family's history and his own identity. Finally, I must say, and you know I speak the unvarnished truth, I read the book four times in manuscript while Martin was writing it and refining it. But just this month, I decided to read it as a book, to hold it in my hands and read it as a book. I finally have enough distance from the text, and I can tell you, it's a remarkable accomplishment by a gifted writer. Please welcome my beloved husband, author of The Inextinguishable Symphony, Martin Goldsmith.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Amy. Thank you. This is about my 65th or 75th book appearance, and that was a unique introduction. all of you should experience being introduced by your spouses at one point or another. Of course, it's interesting to learn of Amy's deep and abiding affection for the Marlboro Man. I guess I should be glad she hasn't taken up smoking. Thanks also to Marvin Granger for many things, not least tendering that invitation to me and giving Amy that modulated push in the direction of Bozeman. That was wonderful, and thanks for that wonderful toast at the wedding. And I also want to acknowledge that as Amy said, I was beginning my quest into my family story when we first spoke 6.5 years ago. But I've told her this, and I would like to tell you as well, that I believe in a very real sense that I would not have written the book had I not met Amy. She has been an inspiration in many, many ways. She was terrifically important in various practical ways in the writing of the book. After I'd secured a contract with John Wiley & Sons, we spent a few days on a beautiful island off the coast of Maine, and it was there that Amy suggested that I travel to Germany, not only to do research for the book, but also to walk down the streets where my parents walked, even though that was, by that time, 60 and 65 years later. She said, you will discover things in those streets and breathing the air that they breathed. And she was absolutely and profoundly right. And she turned out to be not only a wonderful interviewer, but a magnificent editor as well. I don't know how many times as she was reading over the manuscript of the book, she would say, you know, this sentence lasts 15 words, and you really only need 12 of those words. Or this paragraph and the next paragraph really need some kind of connective tissue between them. They don't really flow together. Or this paragraph, just get rid of it. It doesn't belong there at all. Or what you really mean to say is this. And 99 out of 100 times, she was absolutely right. So I need to thank her as editor, but also more profoundly because as an Eastern capital E phrase that I like to repeat from time to time goes, when the student is ready, the guru appears. And I think just as I was ready, my lovely guru appeared. So thank you very much. I'm looking forward to talking about the Inextinguishable Symphony with you, and as Marvin said, answering whatever questions you might have. But I'd like to begin, with your indulgence, by reading the opening chapter of the book, because it puts certain things in context. It goes like this. The first scene of the opera Die Walküre, the second of the four operas making up Richard Wagner's Ring cycle, takes place in the house of Hunding, a fierce warlord. The central feature of Hunding's house is a mighty ash tree, its trunk soaring up from the floor, its branches forming a canopy over the roof. Embedded in the massive trunk is a golden sword the god Wotan has left for his son, the hero Siegmund, to find and wield at his hour of need. In the house where I grew up with my father, my mother, and my brother, there was also an enormous tree growing up through the roof, its great trunk dominating the enclosed space. In many ways, we shared a perfectly ordinary family life. My father spoke to my mother tucked me in at night, my brother and I played with each other when we weren't fighting. But none of us ever acknowledged the tree. The tree wasn't real, of course, but its impact on my family was overwhelming. The effort it required for all of us not to take conscious notice of it was also huge. This enormous presence in our house was the fate of my parents' families, Jews who lived in Germany in the 1930s, and my parents' escape from that fate. Their story, so similar to and yet so different from the 6 million other stories of that time and place, affected everything these two people did. It was at the root of their lives and grew ever upward as they grew older. And as in so many other families like ours, it was something we never spoke of. Not that I was completely unaware of the tree and the shadow it cast on our house. When my friends talked about visiting their grandparents at Thanksgiving or going to the ball game with Uncle Ed, I knew that something from the past had made similar excursions impossible for me. And returning to our house following an afternoon of playing in the neighborhood, I was often conscious of taking off my own real personality, hanging it up in the closet with my jacket, and donning a sort of internal costume that would enable me to blend in with the emotional scenery. But again, we never spoke of such things. Let me hasten to say that such talk was never overtly forbidden. By no means was I or my brother ever shushed when we attempted to steer the conversation in certain directions. We simply never made such attempts. As a family, we didn't discuss what had happened in Germany for the same reason that we didn't discuss bauxite mining in Peru. They were both subjects that simply did not exist for us. Nor do I want to give the impression of a dark and gloomy household where silence reigned. Not at all. Life revolved around my mother's activities as a musician, a violist, first as a member of the St. Louis Symphony and later as a member of the Cleveland Orchestra, and that meant that there was always music in the house. My parents' friends and colleagues would often come by for after-concert parties when the house would resound with music and laughter. But every year, the tree grew taller. And as I grew older, I came to be more and more aware of its presence and of how odd it was that we never spoke of it since it dominated the landscape. Its leaves turned yellow and drifted to the ground when my mother died in 1984. The tree itself remained, however, casting its prodigious shadow over my relationship with my father. Finally, as we both grew more aware of the ever-quickening passage of time, I decided to do something about it. In 1992, the year I turned 40, I was traveling in Europe while my father, who was nearly 79, was also in Europe with his new love, Emily Irwin. We arranged to meet in Oldenburg, my father's hometown. We visited his childhood home, and he told me something of his memories of that long-ago time. He took me to where his father's store had been and told me that Nazi thugs had organized a boycott of the store in April 1933, an action that led to his father's having to sell the family house. He showed me the Pferdemarkt, the horse market, where his father had been taken following his arrest in November 1938. Slowly, those shadowy figures, my grandparents, whom I'd never known, began to take on human form. And for the first time, my father and I began to take notice of that huge tree in our house. It wasn't a fast process by any means. A year later, while visiting my father in Tucson, I tried to get him to talk more about his youth. He spoke only briefly, however, and quickly moved the conversation on to something else. It was obvious that he found these trips into the past very painful. But I persisted in my efforts to talk to him about those days, believing that coming to terms with them would somehow benefit both him and our relationship. And that visit to Tucson resulted in something extraordinary. He agreed to come to Washington, D.C. and tour with me the newly opened United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. A few days before my father's arrival, I happened to mention our plan to Alex Chadwick, a friend of mine at National Public Radio. Alex asked if he could come along with the microphone and record my father's reactions. Both my father and I agreed, and in late January 1994, the three of us visited the museum. Those hours marked a turning point in my father's life and in our relationship. At first, I thought I had made a terrible mistake in asking him to come to the museum. To tour the permanent exhibition, you enter an elevator that takes you up to the top floor, from where you walk back down to ground level. When we stepped out of the elevator, the first image that met my father's eyes was a huge photograph of General Eisenhower touring a concentration camp after the war, surrounded by the skeletal remains of former prisoners. My father gasped and tried to get back into the elevator, but the doors had already closed. Alex and I steadied him, and we made our way through the rest of the museum, the names and faces, the piles of shoes and eyeglasses, the cattle car, and an oboe played by the man who had sat right next to my father in the Berlin Jüdische Kulturbund Orchestra. My father took it all in and spoke very little. But the next day he came to NPR and recorded an interview with Alex, trying, he said, to explain the unexplainable. Alex prepared a feature for NPR's morning edition, and suddenly people all over America began calling my father to tell him that they had been moved by his story. He, in turn, was moved by their interest. Having lived in silence with his thoughts and his memories for so long, he had come to feel isolated from other people. Now those people were reaching out to him, and the effect was transforming for both of us. He now felt more at ease with his past and with me. I had always felt distanced from him, but now I saw him in a different light, less as someone who had deliberately shut me out, and more as someone who had heroically overcome the horrors of the Third Reich to establish a normal and rich life in a foreign land. We became good friends, and we began to talk about his early years in Germany. The more I learned, the more I respected him, and the more I learned about myself as well. I discovered an important source of my feelings for music. It's beautiful and moving, of course, but music also literally saved my parents' lives. Had they not been members of an all-Jewish orchestra, maintained at the pleasure of Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda, they would never have made it out of Germany alive. During their years in Berlin, before their escape, my parents frequently risked everything by defying the Nazi curfews so that they could play chamber music with their friends. As I heard my father tell me his story, I came to realize that somehow I had inherited the knowledge that music can not only enrich your life, it is also something worth risking your life for. I came to see that my chosen profession has been no accident. Maybe, in fact, it chose me. I learned that the tree growing in our house, like the ash tree in the house of Hunding, also contained a golden sword buried deep within its trunk. My parents' story of music and courage and persistence and luck was no weapon, but it has proven to be a source of great strength and inspiration for me. By sharing his life, my father has enabled me to extract and possess a rich treasure of understanding and hope. That's hope. Thank you. Thanks very much. That's how the book begins, and there follow about 350 pages or so about my parents' lives and about the lives of their families and about that extraordinary organization that my parents were a part of, the Jüdische Kulturbund, the Jewish Culture Association, an organization that came about as the result of what the Nazis did in the weeks and months following Adolf Hitler's becoming Chancellor of Germany on January 30th, 1933. The Nazis had many things on their plate, many things they hoped to accomplish, but one of the very first things they did do was to begin systematically kicking Jews out of German orchestras, opera companies, and theater companies, so that by April of 1933, there were about 8,000 unemployed Jewish artists in Germany. And a few of them came together to form this Kulturbund, this cultural association, reasoning that if they could no longer make art for their fellow Germans, they could at least make art for their fellow Jews. They nominated to be their spokesperson a very interesting man by the name of Kurt Singer. until January 1933, Kurt Singer had been the assistant director of the Berlin City Opera. He was a theater director, he was a conductor. He had actually been trained as a neurologist and as a psychiatrist. He had fought in the trenches of the First World War. Very, very interesting man with what was apparently a hypnotic personality. And he was chosen to be the artistic director of the Kulturbund. He quickly reasoned that the organization wouldn't get anywhere unless it had official Nazi sanction. So he began knocking on various ministries within the Nazi hierarchy until he came upon a man by the name of Hans Hinkel, who had been with Adolf Hitler for 10 years already. He had been a part of the famous beer hall putsch in Munich in 1923. If you would ask him, he would very proudly show you his Nazi identification card with the number 287 on it. He was, again, one of the very first people to fall into line behind Adolf Hitler. He also considered himself something of a cultured man, and he agreed to be the Nazi liaison to the Kulturbund. The two of them, Hinkel on one hand and Kurt Singer on the other, began negotiating, and by the summer and early fall of 1933, the ground rules for the formation of the Kulturbund had been established. Hans Hinkel eventually rose to become the number two man behind Joseph Goebbels in what was called the Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda. And I should hasten to say that Herr Hinkel and Herr Goebbels did not allow the Kulturbund to come into existence and did not then encourage, actively support the Kulturbund because they were nice guys or because they had any interest in Jewish culture. Far from it. They were very interested in the formation of the Kulturbund as a propaganda tool and as a way to further their aims. The Nazis hoped to establish a society that was, in their word, Judenrein, or free of Jews. And the idea of Jewish cultural association, making art over in the corner somewhere, very much fell into line behind that idea of segregating the Jews away from mainstream German society. And more insidiously, the Nazis saw the Kulturbund as a wonderful propaganda tool, as international criticism of the Nazis' treatment of the Jews began to arise, such as it did, the Nazis were able to shrug their shoulders and ask plaintively, well, how bad can it be for the Jews? Look, they have their own orchestra. They have their own opera company. I mean, obviously, we're treating them just fine. So from the very beginning, the Kulturbund had complete support from the Nazi officials. The Kulturbund set out to put on plays, to put on operas, symphony concerts, chamber concerts, they showed films, they sponsored lectures, all for the Jews of Germany. In order to be a performing member of the Kulturbund, to be a musician or an actor or a dancer or to work in the box office or to work in the scene shop or to clean the lavatories, to do any of those things, you had to be Jewish. In order to attend performances by the Kulturbund, you had to be Jewish. If you were married and your spouse was not Jewish, he or she was forbidden from attending these performances. The Kulturbund raised its curtain for the first time on October 1st, 1933, during the high holidays of that year, in Berlin, with a production of a play called Nathan the Wise by an 18th century German playwright named Gotthold Lessing. Nathan the Wise, ironically enough, is a play all about religious toleration. It was a big hit on that one night, perhaps too big a hit, because that night, October 1st, 1933, was the first and last time that Nathan the Wise was ever performed in Nazi Germany. Anything the Kulturbund wanted to do, they had to run by Hans Hinkel and Joseph Goebbels and the censors of the Nazi hierarchy. The first Kulturbund, as I said, raised its curtain in Berlin, but by the end of 1933, the first branch organization had opened its doors in Cologne, and by the high watermark of the Kulturbund, there were such organizations in 49 cities across Germany, and about 70,000 people were card-carrying members of the Kulturbund. The organization had some extraordinary artists taking part in their productions. The conductor of the Kulturbund Orchestra in Frankfurt was a man by the name of Hans Wilhelm Steinberg. Herr Steinberg later emigrated to this country, and under the name William Steinberg was the music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic, the Pittsburgh Symphony, and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. William Steinberg, one of the most important American conductors of the latter part of the 20th century. Boris Kreutz was a violist with the Kulturbund. He later emigrated to this country and was the longtime violist of the Budapest String Quartet in residence at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Ernst Drucker, whose son is Eugene Drucker, a member of the Emerson String Quartet. Ernst Drucker was the concertmaster of the Frankfurt Kulturbund Orchestra. The Kulturbund also named among its members the actors Jenny Bernstein and Alfred Berliner. They had some really first-rate artists in their midst. And they did some wonderful work as well. The first ever performance in Germany of the play Six Characters in Search of an Author by Luigi Pirandello was a Kulturbund production. The first time that the opera Nabucco by Giuseppe Verdi was ever performed in Germany, it was a Kulturbund production. As I say, everything they did had to be run by Goebbels and Hinkel and the censors. From the very beginning, they figured it probably was not terribly wise for them to perform music by Richard Wagner or Richard Strauss, a couple of composers whom the Nazis held in particularly high regard. But at first, they were allowed to perform music by other German composers, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Schumann, and the like. But after a couple of years, the Nazis decreed that for a Jewish musician to play music by Beethoven, or for a Jewish actor to speak the words of Goethe, was somehow to defile this great German art. And so those musicians, those composers and playwrights were declared off limits for the Kulturbund. In 1938, in March of 38, after the forcible takeover of Austria by the Nazis, the so-called Anschluss, Austrian composers, Mozart, Haydn, Schubert, were also put on the verboten list. Leaving the Kulturbund, able to perform music by Jewish composers, Mendelssohn, Mahler, and all the foreign composers they chose. Likewise, the Kulturbund actors relied heavily on plays by such foreign-born playwrights as Molière and Shakespeare, but they could not do any German playwrights. But this was it. The Kulturbund was the only place where the Jews of Germany could come and experience a live performance, to hear an orchestral concert, or to see a film, or to see a play, or to hear a lecture. They were forbidden from attending concerts by the Berlin Philharmonic. They couldn't buy a ticket to their local Bijou in Mannheim or Hamburg to watch a film. The Kulturbund was it for the Jews of Germany, the only place where they could come, be together, and attend performances, even though at every rehearsal and every performance there were two Gestapo agents in the theater to make sure that nothing untoward were to happen, to make sure that the orchestra didn't swing into an unauthorized performance of Beethoven, for instance. Right? Who knew why they were there, but they were there every night. My mother joined the Kulturbund Orchestra in Frankfurt in 1935. She was 18 years old. My mother's father ran a music conservatory in Dusseldorf and had occasion to make music with Hans Wilhelm Steinberg before. He called up Herr Steinberg, managed to get my mother an audition. My mother played audition for Mr. Steinberg, and he hired her to join the viola section of the Kulturbund Orchestra. She played her first concert with them on September 10th, 1935. That date is not particularly significant, but 5 days later was September 15th, 1935, the day that saw the passage of the infamous Nuremberg Laws, the laws by which the Nazis effectively stripped the Jews of Germany of their citizenship and did lots of other nasty things besides. And one of the results of the Nuremberg Laws was that my father, who was studying the flute in the German city of Karlsruhe, was a few weeks later asked to leave the conservatory for what were termed racial reasons. My father then decided, all right, that's it, I've had enough, and he decided to pack up and emigrate to Sweden. And in fact, over the next weeks and months, found himself an apartment over a milk bar in Stockholm. And that is how the situation stood in early March of 1936, when the phone rang in my father's apartment, and a man at the other end of the phone asked if he would be able to quick drop what he was doing and come down and play a couple of concerts with this Frankfurt Kulturbund Orchestra. The first flutist of the orchestra had come down with a very bad cold. Well, my father said, well, I'd like to help you out, but there are boxes all over my apartment. I'm getting ready to move to Sweden. Sorry, no can do. Or the German equivalent of that. But the man at the other end of the phone was very persistent. My father eventually agreed. He threw his flute and a couple of other items of clothing into a suitcase and played those two concerts, one in Frankfurt and one in Hamburg, and then duly moved to Sweden. But he couldn't forget the lovely young violist he had met during those two concerts. And later that year, the situation presented itself for him to leave the safety of Sweden and to return to Nazi Germany to be with the woman who would later become his wife and my mother. Again, with your indulgence, I would like to read a couple of paragraphs that describe that that moment. My father's name at the time was Günther Goldschmidt, and my mother's name was Rosemary Gumpert. And the major work on the program that they played in Frankfurt and Hamburg was the magnificent Pathetique Symphony, the great symphony number 6 by Tchaikovsky. The next day, just hours before leaving for Sweden, Günther mailed Rosemary a copy of Rainer Maria Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. I have the little volume before me now, a precious relic. On the first page is the following inscription, in German, naturally. Rosemary Gumpert, a small memento of two concerts, Tchaikovsky, in Frankfurt and Hamburg in March 1936. G.G. I wonder which of Rilke's gentle and profound observations made the greatest impression on the sender and on the recipient. More than 60 years later, two in particular strike me. Rilke wrote, "Destiny is like a wonderful wide tapestry in which every thread is guided by an unspeakably tender hand, placed beside another thread and held and carried by 100 others." And Rilke also wrote, "It is always my wish that you might find enough patience within yourself to endure and enough innocence to have faith. Believe me, life is right in all cases." A few days later, Günther was thrilled to receive a return envelope from Frankfurt. Inside, he found an enthusiastic letter from Rosemary, thanking him for the book and expressing her happiness at having met him. But she had addressed the letter to Gustav Goldschmidt, apparently confusing him with the King of Sweden. It must have been a wee bit exasperating for Günther to think that he had made so little an impression upon the object of his affection that she couldn't even remember his name. But having inherited my mother's occasional difficulties with such matters, I can only smile with love and indulgence. What, indeed, is in a name? Thus began an ardent correspondence between Frankfurt and Stockholm, and believing, as did Rilke, in the beautifully woven destiny and in the rightness of life, Günther, after spending 6 months in the white night safety of Sweden and engaging in a regular and intense correspondence with Rosemary, decided to go back to Germany to be near her. The opportunity presented itself when the same flutist who'd caught cold in March fled to Palestine in August. Foolishly, or romantically, or both, my father accepted the position of principal flutist of the Frankfurt Kulturbund Orchestra. Would I have done the same thing? Whatever my answer, I have the advantage of hindsight, of knowing the terrors of the next 10 years. But still, even in the late summer of 1936, my father must have known what a damn fool thing he was doing, deliberately and with all his faculties intact, voluntarily going back to Nazi Germany, to the country whose leader had vowed to eradicate his kind from the earth forever. And for what? Ah, for love. For music and for love. I don't know if I would have done it, but I do know that I love and admire him for it. I think it's the most wonderful story I know. Thank you again. So my parents played together on the same stage in Frankfurt for the next couple of years. As more and more Jews began to emigrate to safety, by this time it was 1936 and 1937 and early 1938, as more and more Jews left Germany, naturally there were fewer Jews left to make up the roster of the various Kulturbund organizations around Germany, and there were fewer people who were able to attend Kulturbund performances. So after a while, some of these Kulturbund organizations began to close their doors. And that, in fact, happened with the Kulturbund in Frankfurt. At the end of the 1937-38 season, it was announced that the Kulturbund in Frankfurt was closing. So my parents joined the main office, so to speak, the Kulturbund Orchestra in Berlin. They arrived in Berlin in time to play down in the pit for what were apparently some wonderful performances of Giuseppe Verdi's opera Rigoletto. And that production of Rigoletto went on through October of 1938. And at the end of that production, my mother went back to Düsseldorf to spend a couple of weeks with her parents. And my father stayed in Berlin practicing his flute, anticipating the first rehearsal of the Kulturbund Orchestra of Berlin, which was scheduled for sometime in mid-November. And that is how matters stood on the 9th of November, 1938, the night remembered as Kristallnacht, or the night of broken glass, or simply the November pogrom, the night when Nazi thugs roamed Germany from border to border, smashing the shop windows of Jewish businesses, setting fire to synagogues, dragging Jews from their homes, stomping them oftentimes to death, arresting many, many more Jews. And that night, my father was lucky enough to get out of the house where he was living unscathed to make his way down to the train station in Berlin and catch a train heading west. He decided to go to Düsseldorf to be with his beloved. So he traveled by train all that dark and crystal night, arriving early the next morning in Düsseldorf, where he walked through the still very dangerous streets of Düsseldorf, to Boltensternstrasse, where my mother's family lived. He hid out in their attic for the next several days until the worst of the danger had passed. And then about a month later, my parents decided to get married on December 13th, 1938. They were married in the offices of the Justice of the Peace, a man wearing the brown uniform of the SA. And they were married beneath a full-length portrait of Adolf Hitler, his hand resting on the noble head of a German shepherd, both of them looking out over the mountains of Berchtesgaden. That was the only decoration for my parents' wedding. They then went back to Berlin and played in the Kulturbund Orchestra for the next several years. Finally, the late 1939, early 1940, they were the recipients of some very, very good fortune considering their conditions at the time, their circumstances. As I read in the first chapter of the book, they were devout chamber music players, often risking their lives. There was one statute after decree, after regulation, after another passed against the Jews of Germany by the Nazis, and eventually a curfew was passed stating that during the winter months, Jews had to be off the streets of Germany by 8 p.m. and by 9 p.m. during the summertime. My parents would often flout those rules and risk being arrested by being on the streets of Germany after curfew because they were so devoted to playing chamber music, and they would sneak through the streets of Berlin to meet up with friends to play Mozart quartets or the Beethoven serenade. And because they became known in chamber music circles, they were invited to play a series of concerts in, of all places, the American Embassy in Berlin. And it was there that they met a woman whom my father remembers only as Mrs. Schneider. And when the time came, Mrs. Schneider helped them to fill out the forms that they would need to receive visas to come to the United States. Eventually, their visas did arrive on the 27th of February, 1941, coincidentally on the same day that the Kulturbund put on a memorable performance of the Resurrection Symphony, the Symphony No. 2 by Gustav Mahler. My parents, having gotten their visas, then secured passage on a ship coming to the New World, the good ship Mugino, which left Lisbon on the 10th of June, 1941. They arrived at Ellis Island on June 21st, 1941, quite literally just in time. Fewer than 3 months later, the Kulturbund was shut down. On September 1st, 1941, the Nazis revive the medieval practice of forcing the Jews of Germany to wear the yellow star. And just 10 days after that, September 11th, 1941, word came down that the Kulturbund was henceforth dissolved. It was of no more use to the Nazis. As far as it being a propaganda tool for the Nazis, they had been practicing their propaganda for the past couple of years on the battlefield. And as far as the Kulturbund supporting the Nazi ideal of a society that was Judenrein, by 1941 that was a primitive reminder of early attempts by the Nazis to solve what they were fond of calling the Jewish problem. Early in 1933, a solution to the Jewish problem was having the Jews off in a corner making music and putting on plays. By September 1941, that was a primitive reminder of early solutions to the Jewish problem. By this time, the Nazis were readying their final solution to the Jewish problem, and so the Kulturbund was no longer useful, and it was shut down, and all members of the Kulturbund who had not managed to get out by that time were sent to the camps. So my parents were extraordinarily fortunate, having gotten out with fewer than 3 months to spare. The rest of their families were not so fortunate, however. My father's father ran a woman's clothing store in Oldenburg. He had moved to Oldenburg in 1906, had opened the store in 1911. He fought in the trenches of the First World War, winning the Iron Cross First Class for his efforts. The same medal, by the way, that a young corporal from Austria named Adolf Hitler had won. But all of that meant for nothing after 1933. And on Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938, my grandfather was arrested. And the following morning, he was taken to the Pferdemarkt, the horse market, the central square in Oldenburg. And he and 42 other adult Jews of the town were paraded, marched through the city of Oldenburg, past the smoking ruins of the synagogue on Peterstrasse to the Oldenburg prison, where they spent a night in prison. They were then put on a railroad train heading east to the concentration camp Sachsenhausen, where my grandfather stayed for the next 3 weeks. He was then released, told that he had 6 months to leave the country or else he would face further arrest. So my grandfather made arrangements to travel to the New World with his younger son, my father's younger brother, and the plan was that they would come to the New World, establish a beachhead over here, and then send for the rest of the family. But alas, they had the misfortune to book passage on the infamous refugee ship known as the St. Louis, which left Hamburg on May 13th, 1939, bound for Havana. It did, in fact, make it all the way to Havana's port, where it dropped anchor, only to find out that a power play going on in the upper reaches of the Cuban government made it impossible for the more than 900 Jewish refugees on board the St. Louis to disembark. The ship then weighed anchor, sailed north to the coast of Florida, where it plied the waters off Miami for a couple of days, imploring the U.S. State Department and President Roosevelt again to be allowed to disembark its passengers. The ship was close enough to the coast that they were able to see the lights of Miami, but the State Department and President Roosevelt turned down their request. The ship then sailed back across the Atlantic. On the way back east, a deal was brokered whereby the refugees on board the St. Louis would be allowed to disembark in one of four countries, England, France, Belgium, or Holland. My grandfather and uncle got off in France. By this time, it was late June of 1939. They were put into a displaced persons camp near Le Mans. Just 10 weeks later was September 1st, 1939, the outbreak of the Second World War, and my grandfather and uncle metamorphosed overnight from displaced persons to enemy aliens, since they bore German passports and Germany and France were now at war. So my relatives were transported to some very awful camps in the south of France, concentration camps in all but name, known as Rivesalt and Les Milles, where they stayed for the next several years. By this time, in June of 1941, my mother and father had made it to this country. But my relatives in the camps in France were still there in June of 41 and were there a year later in June of 42. My two grandmothers were by this time living together in Berlin, and my father's younger sister also was living in that house in Berlin. And all of my relatives would quite regularly send letters to my parents in New York, begging them to do whatever they could to save them, to get them out, to bring them somehow to this country. Although that was very, very difficult because the United States at the time was still operating under the strictures of the 1924 Emigration Act, which had quotas for how many people from various countries could be allowed to come to the United States. And more Jews from Germany and Austria were trying to come to America than were allowed by the quota system. So, as we know, so many people were trapped inside Germany and Austria and perished. The last letter that my father received from his father was dated June 9th, 1942. In it, my grandfather went over the very awful conditions under which he and his younger son had been living, and included these words, "We have described for you how we are living here. Again, we implore you to do everything you can to get us out. If you do not, it will be on your conscience." And within just a couple of months, August of 1942, my grandfather and uncle were transported via Drancy to Auschwitz, and my two grandmothers were also sent away to death camps, as was the case with my father's younger sister. That is, in large measure, the story of the book, the story of the Kulturbund and of my parents' families. But I would like to conclude, before I entertain questions and comments, just by reading to you the last couple of pages of the book. It describes a fairly extraordinary afternoon that I spent in Germany a little over 1 year ago. These are the last two pages of the book. Wednesday, November 10th, 1999. A cloudy, chilly afternoon in Oldenburg. So much time during the preparation of this book I have spent living in what British historian G.M. Trevelyan called that land of mystery, which we call the past. Today, as the century nears its end, the mystery reaches forward to embrace the present. 61 years after my grandfather Alex Goldschmidt marched through these streets at the point of a gun, the citizens of Oldenburg have gathered to retrace his steps. For more than a decade, a group of Oldenburgers has come together every year to commemorate the anniversary of that most shameful moment in their city's 650-year history. The march, which follows the exact route taken by the captive Jews and their Nazi guards, is Oldenburg's way of atoning for the sins of its forebears, its grammatically declared ritual of remembrance. My brother Peter and I have come to honor our father and grandparents by taking part in the march. We have been welcomed warmly, in particular by Oldenburg's mayor, Hiltrud Neidhart, and her husband, Roland, by Ali Zahedi, an Iranian-born writer and filmmaker, and by a young Lutheran pastor named Dietgard Dimitriadis. They are pleased that we have come all this way to join them. We are overwhelmed by their kindness and hospitality. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, about 300 people have gathered in the Pferdemarkt, the market square where Alex and his 42 fellow prisoners began their ordeal. After a few solemn words by one of this year's organizers, we begin to walk. The line of people stretches for more than 100 yards. Old folks, school children, mothers with baby carriages, young men pushing bicycles, a woman in a wheelchair. Two marchers carry a banner that reads, November 10th, 1938. Nothing is forgotten. No one is forgotten. In the whirl of emotions and sensations, I am struck by two things. Policemen, so unlike the police 61 years ago, assist us in our effort, stopping traffic at intersections and easing our way. And the silence. 300 people walk almost noiselessly through the streets. Pedestrians cease their conversations as we approach. Drivers in automobiles that have been stopped to let us pass wait silently, patiently enduring the traffic. It seems as if the entire city is taking part. We walk the cobblestone streets of the old city, pass within a block of the site of my grandfather's store, emerge onto Elizabethstrasse, where it borders the Schlossgarten. Slowly the clouds part, and the late afternoon sun pours its benediction upon us through the golden trees. It is like a peaceful dream. But then we turn left, and the dream is over. The grim and ugly prison, its dirty red walls topped by razor wire, stands waiting today as it did for my grandfather. Its not unarguable presence is a shock, an almost palpable blow. The prison's heavy iron gate has been drawn back. Its courtyard stands open. I am painfully aware that I am about to cross its threshold to recreate that awful step when Alex Goldschmidt's life essentially ended. No. I notice the Pastor Dimitriades is at my side. She has sensed my discomfort. She touches my arm and softly asks my grandfather's name. His name was Alex, I say, grateful for the interruption. She nods and moves off. When we walk into the prison courtyard, I am still deeply aware of the significance of the moment, but my agitation has eased. Two brief speeches. Two teenage girls sing a Jewish folk song. The march is ended. My heart numb, I turn to find my brother Peter. But there again is Pastor Dimitriades. She takes my hands and looks unblinkingly into my eyes. When Cain slew Abel, she says to me, God marked him with his brother's name so that all could see it. That mark has kept Abel's name alive across the generations. Those whom Germany killed have had their names kept alive by the mark with which God has touched my country. She smiles sadly and continues ever so softly. And that's the case with Alex. His name shall live forever. The pastor hugs me then, and I sob on her shoulder, crying for those poor people in their unmarked graves, the relatives I never knew and miss so much. Before I leave the city that cast out my grandfather and has now welcomed me back, I revisit the Oldenburg Archives, a modern glass and steel building no more than half a mile from the prison. The archivists show me a roster of Oldenburg citizens. I direct them to the page marked Goldschmidt and inform them that Günther, son of Alex, has a son named Martin who was married in October 1999. They eagerly write down names, addresses, dates of birth. Our family is not extinguished. Thank you. Thanks very much. I believe this gentleman down here, stage right, your left, he is prepared to run through the audience. So if you want to raise your hand, if you have a question or a comment, the microphone will come your way. And I guess the plan is for people to continue to raise hands, and the microphone will get there. Yes, sir.
Martin, there is such exquisite detail in your telling that I would almost accuse you of going back in an astral figure and riding on your parents' shoulders. How did you go about getting such an intimate acquaintance with even their dialogue and so on?
Some of the dialogue I had to imagine based on what they would say in under certain circumstances, but there are certain aspects of their story that my father remembers with extraordinary clarity. I was also very, very helped a great deal by the archives of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and of the Akademie der Künste in Berlin, a museum that mounted an exhibition about the Kulturbund in 1992. I was able to find out the exact programs of concerts and of plays that had been put on. I was also able to talk to a number of other members of the Kulturbund. I took an ad out in a German newspaper called the Aufbau, a German Jewish newspaper called the Aufbau. Took out an ad asking for anyone who had ever been a member of the Kulturbund, who had attended performances by the Kulturbund, to please get in touch with me. And a number of people did. I was able to talk to them as well. And through all of that, I wove together the story. But thank you for thinking it holds together.
Yes.
Yes.
My question back here has to do specifically with the recent publication of a book that literally terms the Holocaust, writing about the Holocaust, a Holocaust industry. And I guess I'm wondering, has your very personal story in any way been drawn into this larger argument? And do you see yourself writing this very personal story suddenly being put on this larger stage where you're having to defend what it is that you're doing, or what any of you, anybody who has these types of story to tell are doing?
The gentleman's question refers to this book called The Holocaust Industry. I have not read the book. I've read a couple of reviews of the book, and as I understand it, the author essentially says, well, as you might tell by the title of the book, that the various aspects of this thing that we now know of as the Holocaust have been discussed in so many places, in so many ways, that it has begun to be a bit unseemly. And I have not, in answer, direct answer to your question, I have not been, quote, accused, unquote, of that. Though I must tell you that even before I began to write the book, I began to feel a little squishy about not sharing the story. I think it's a very important story, certainly as far as the Kulturbund is concerned. Up to now, there has been very, very little written about the Kulturbund in the English language, and I think it's very important that this story be told. And I think that my parents' story is a lovely love story. But I did not want to appear to be, quote, profiting, unquote, from the misery of my parents and of their parents and so on. So I'm certainly very much aware of the feelings that I presume engendered your question. I have not been called to task as of yet. Perhaps tonight is the first night, or the first time. But it is certainly very much, I'm aware.
I guess my question is, I find it to be completely slanderous in the first place that that argument has even come up. And I guess specifically, it seems to me that it in some way deadens the personal nature of it. And I think one of the things that has been made evidently clear tonight is that this is all about these individual stories. And for anyone to suggest that anybody who would want to tell these just truly, in this case, a very beautiful story, would be doing it simply to contribute to an industry seems to me to be just absolutely absurd, number one, and incredibly unseemly. And it seems that we're still fighting the very same things that brought about the Holocaust in the first place. And it is upsetting to me, number one, that this has even happened, but to suggest that what it is that you're here tonight talking to us about is contributing to an industry is just absolutely maddening. And I guess my question, the larger question is do you find yourself talking about these issues, talking about Holocaust issues, and do you see yourself now as a spokesperson for the Holocaust?
I think I can speak with some degree of authority about the Kulturbund. I can certainly speak about my parents' story and my family's story. The Holocaust is such an immense issue, and there are those who have written very eloquently about it, and I guess I would prefer to leave those other questions to others. I'll be glad to talk about the Kulturbund virtually anywhere. But I appreciate your thoughts and your sentiments, sir. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I'd like to respond to this notion of the industry of the Holocaust, and it seems to me that it perpetuates this problem of minorities, because I cannot imagine that such an idea would have been promoted had the vast majority of Americans, for example, gone through that particular experience. We certainly do not hear of the industry of the crucifixion.
Martin, when I read your book, it was kind of like having my finger in a socket. I couldn't stop, and I didn't want to continue. And tonight, now you read this, and the whole thing comes back again. The book becomes personal. And I'm wondering what kind of things have been coming back to you about your journeys for the book, and also the people who are reading it. What kind of feedback are you getting about the impact?
Extraordinary feedback. I have been, the book came out in September, and I've been doing a great deal of traveling around the country talking about the book. And I mentioned, I read in the first chapter about the tree image, and it's been very gratifying to have a number of people around my age say to me, there was a tree growing in our house too. There seem to have been a lot of people who are my age, who are the sons and daughters of people who experienced the horrors that are, again, lumped together under the phrase the Holocaust. And they have said to me that in their family as well, it was not talked about. And therefore, they were very pleased to not only have the book written, but to have this image of the tree, which they understood so powerfully and so well. There was a gentleman in Atlanta who spoke to me and said, I celebrated my 7th birthday on board the St. Louis. I may have run into your grandfather or your uncle, he said to me. So many people have said to me, I'd never heard of the Kulturbund. This is a first for me. And I'm very proud to have brought that extraordinary organization to the attention of so many people. So it's been wonderful, actually. Something I hadn't really counted upon. And it's a wonderful and very, this is a cliched phrase, but a heart-warming and heart-uplifting aspect of this whole journey, which is continuing. Yes? Sure, I will try to. It has made me more aware of how I am connected to my past, because again, these grandparents were people I never knew at all, and somehow they have come more alive. I have become more aware of other people as well. I mean, I've been connected to so many people, like the folks I was talking about a moment ago. There's obviously a great number of people whose lives are still very much affected by the events of 60 years ago. It has made me more aware of myself as a Jew. I wasn't aware of this at all growing up. I didn't attend my first Seder until I was 16. To this day, my father thinks of himself or calls himself a so-called Jew or a someone of Jewish background. And it's only recently that, I mean, during the writing of the book that I began to question what it meant to be a Jew. And I have been attending services at a synagogue in Washington a lot more. I'm considering getting bar mitzvah at my advanced age. It's hard to describe everything, but it has been a very good friend of mine back in Washington, as I was beginning to write this book, said to me, your life is going to change dramatically after you've written this. And she was right. It has, in ways that I can speak about and many more ways that I can't. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I heard your interview on public radio a day or two ago when you were talking about Wagner and saying the finale of the Ring Cycle is the most magnificent music, and the interviewer asked you, how can you deal with Wagner, and isn't that a problem, or isn't it for other Jewish people? And you said sometimes you have to leave things at the door. But how do you, given what's gone on in your family, overcome what some of us who are Jewish have this great struggling feelings with Germans and with Germany and with Wagner and the whole history. That was a wonderful interview, by the way.
Thank you. Let me first say that I completely understand anyone who says, because of what happened 60 years ago, I choose not to go to Germany, or I choose not to drive a Volkswagen, or I choose not to listen to Wagner. I understand the depths of emotion that would cause someone to come to that conclusion. And I would be the last person on earth to say that a person who feels that way should go to Germany, or should drive a Volkswagen, or should listen to Richard Wagner. That being said, I think that Richard Wagner is one of the great artists to have walked this planet. He was apparently a very unpleasant man. His anti-Semitism was only part of his being a very unpleasant man. He once, in a pamphlet that he wrote in the 1850s, described Jews as cannibals. He also hired a conductor named Hermann Levy to conduct the premiere of his most Christian opera, Parsifal. He was an unpleasant man who died 50 years, exactly 50 years, before Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. And even though Hitler wrapped himself in the mantle of Wagner, even though Hitler said, if anyone wishes to understand National Socialism, he must first understand Richard Wagner. Even though Hitler went to Bayreuth and publicly embraced the children of Wagner, many of whom were ardent National Socialists, it is possible for me to come to the intellectual conclusion that Richard Wagner had nothing to do with Adolf Hitler's embracing him as the musical spokesperson of the National Socialists. I think that if any person shuts himself or herself off from Wagner, they are doing themselves a great disservice, because Wagner is an elementally beautiful and stunning and inspiring artist. And there was a concert of Wagner's, a concert that took place last October, which included Wagner's Siegfried Idol, a concert in Israel. The first time that a concert was actually sanctioned to go ahead and perform music by Wagner. The concert was the subject of a Supreme Court ruling. The Israeli Supreme Court eventually ruled that the concert could go ahead. And before the performance, a young Israeli composer stood up and said, in effect, "The Nazis told us that we could not listen to Wagner. The Nazis said we could not perform Wagner. The Jews had no way of interpreting this great music. If we continue to shut ourselves off from Wagner, we are continuing that ban. We are censoring ourselves from this glorious music." And again, this was a composer who was the grandson of Holocaust victims, but he has chosen to go forward. And again, I would not impose Wagner on anybody, but I would urge anybody who wants to learn a little bit more about the human condition to listen to Wagner. Yes, sir.
Martin, I enjoyed your book. I thought the most poignant love story was the one between you and your dad, though, that seemed to be in the subtext in every page. How's he doing?
He's doing okay. He's 87. He's 87, so but he continues to walk about a mile and a half every day. He is as sharp as a tack. He listens to music, attends concerts, attends plays. And I like to think that he is a happier person than he was before the book was written. Not that, you know, I had anything to do with that, but having told his story, I think he feels a little bit less ashamed and guilt-ridden. He still does. I know that it was difficult for him to read some of the letters from his parents, some of which I quoted in the book. But I think he's happy with how the book turned out, and he's doing okay. I mean, aches and pains and so on, but I think he's in pretty good shape.
Martin, could you talk about the forbidden music, what's it called, the Entartete Musik,
that has been recently recorded, I think, Decca London, by German artists for the most part.
Yes.
Who were those, why were those works forbidden, and were they forbidden works or just forbidden composers?
The phrase Antarctica was first used in, used in conjunction with an art exhibition. One of the very first, it was interesting. I mean, those of us who are constantly arguing about the importance of art to a society, sometimes cringe when we realize how important art was to the Nazis. By that I mean they saw how important art was. One of the very first things they did, as I said, was to kick Jews out of orchestras, opera companies, and theater companies, and they began labeling visual art as degenerate, Antarctica Kunst. And the very first Antarctica Kunst exhibition was held, coincidentally enough, in my mother's hometown of Dusseldorf in, I think, 1935. And the Nazis hoped to continue their propaganda offensive against the Jews by saying, look at all of this awful art, this subversive art put forth by Jewish artists. I mean, here they have the unclothed human figure, and they have other aspects of human condition of the human condition that they say we should learn about. And it's degenerate, I tell you, degenerate. And we have this exhibition opening up in Dusseldorf of degenerate art, and we invite you to go see this and be appalled. Well, they had to close down the exhibition after just a few weeks because so many people were going through the exhibition twice and three times and four times and five times, just because it was a collection of simply magnificent art that, of course, the Nazis decreed was degenerate, and yet people responded to it very deeply and lovingly. And so the degenerate art exhibition had to be closed. Art of the sort favored by the Nazi censors was once more put forward. Then the term was advanced to, or was included, included music as well, Antarctica Musik, degenerate music, and that was certainly jazz was considered degenerate because, among other things, it had African roots. And certain composers' music was determined to be degenerate, Antarctica, largely Jewish composers, but not by any means only Jewish composers. But as Marvin said, the London record label has come forward over the last several years and has begun recording and releasing performances by these composers who were determined to be, by the Nazis, degenerate. I certainly know that closer to our own time, and I really mean to make no comparisons, believe me, but I certainly know that Daniel Schorr, a longtime CBS correspondent and now National Public Radio correspondent, always found that being on Richard Nixon's enemies list to be a mark of honor. I'm certain that a number of the Antarctica composers felt the same way, assuming they were able to enjoy their designation with a longer life. I had the opportunity to interview one of the Antarctica composers, whose name was Goldschmidt, no relation at all, but he lived in London and survived until just a few years ago in his 90s. Berthold Goldschmidt was his name. There being no more questions or comments, thank you. Thank you. I cannot tell you what a great pleasure it is to be back here, not only where I got me a wife, as Aaron Copland might say, But to be here in the within the sound of the mighty signal of Yellowstone Public Radio, and it's a wonderful general manager and inspiration, Marvin Granger.
Thank you very much, Martin. We are just delighted that both of you could do this, and thank you very much to the audience, although I'm surprised that more people didn't have questions or comments. I think we may have some shy folks here in the audience from Lake Wobegon, maybe. I do want to mention to the audience here once again, and this is really unfair to the radio audience to say this, but there is a reception out in the lobby for Martin and for Amy.
Of course, if you live, you know, within a few blocks, perhaps you could come and join us.
You could. But for the folks in Cutbank and Thermopolis, I think it's kind of probably not very, very fair. Anyway, if you have a book to be signed, Martin will be happy to sign it, and he may have a chance to chat with you. I know Amy has many, many friends here who would like to talk with her. I do want to thank the staff tonight who worked so hard on this, our technical director, Randy Rocks, and Guy Moody, who ran around the room here, although not as much as I thought he was going to, and Steve Buck, who has been handling the sound here and doing very, very well, and Dan Eichland back at the studio. And thank you again to everybody who participated in this wonderful event, and have a good evening. Good night.
Yellowstone Public Radio, KEMC Billings, KBMC Bozeman, KECC Miles City, and KYPR Gillette, serving Montana and northern Wyoming.
Our programming is underwritten by the law firm of Crowley, Hoy, Hanson, Toole, and Dietrich, with offices located in Billings, Bozeman, Helena, Kalispell, and Williston, on the web at crowleylaw.com.